Psalm 40 is our text. I introduced it last week as the psalm that we've prayed for our oldest son who is dealing with addiction issues. And we landed in this psalm because it's a psalm of deliverance. It's David remembering back to a time, a difficult stretch he was in, circumstances which, looking at the psalm, either he brought on himself or he was thrown into, or some combination of both, but circumstances in which he felt helpless, not hopeless. I tried to give the distinction last week, and out of which he got to solid footing, as we see in verse 2, and for which he credits God's work in his life, and on which he wrote this psalm. Look again, verses 1 and 2. I waited patiently for the Lord, and patience is bearing the burden of hoping. That's the operative definition we're going with as we look at this psalm last week and this week and one more week next week. I waited patiently for the Lord. I bore the burden of hoping. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog. That's where we were last week. And set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. But this psalm is not just about deliverance from the hard thing. It's also about God's faithfulness in the hard thing. That's what staves off hopelessness, is the faithfulness of God in the thing as it unfolds, as it sets on us. And we're going to key on this in verses 9 and 10 today. I ended the sermon last week by drawing out a little bit the idea of recovery. Recovery is what it's called when you're dealing successfully with addiction. You've heard probably of recovery communities, and that's what a recovery community is. It's those who've bonded together with this common experience, but they are also dealing with this successfully. And I've loved the word recovery for a long time, even before this experience that we're in, because I remember hearing years ago how a preacher contrasted that in America we call our tow trucks wreckers, but in Britain they call them recovery. And I love that. I love that for two reasons. One is because my secret vocational ambition has always been to be a tow truck driver. And if I retire ever from ministry, that's what you'll find me doing. I will go to work for a tow truck company and will enjoy the heck out of that every day. But also because I love it because recovery is a much more hopeful word than totaled. People are never totaled where God is concerned. In fact, just as a teaser for next week, I'm going to talk about from this week. And last week, I've talked about kind of how our experience, our family, has been from Psalm 40. Next week, I want to talk about the addict. The addict as God's gift to the church. And I'll spell that out for you next week. People are never totaled where God is concerned. But I said last week, specific to this, it's good to have recovery. And I talked about small r recovery, meaning it's good to be out of the throes of addiction. This is a thing that should be celebrated. We want that for our loved ones in their miry bog in particular, that miry bog in particular, but we hope for more. And to hope is to bear a burden. The burden that we bear for our oldest son and for anyone in pits of self-destruction, mired in bogs of all kinds, whether through their own going astray after a lie, to pick up language from verse 4, or by those who delight in our hurt, to pick up language from verse 14 in this psalm, we hope for recovery with a capital R. Because that recovery, capital R recovery, brings us to the ultimate burden bearer. The only one who's large enough to bear the burden of our hope, to contain our hopes, because he did the will of God on our behalf. And we see him in verses 6 through 8. In sacrifice and offering, you've not delighted, but you've given me an open ear. Talk about that next week. It's the idea of you've dug my ear out. Burnt offering and sin offering you've not required. Then I said, behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart. And I remind you again, as I did last week, that these verses are situated in the New Testament in Hebrews chapter 10, which quotes Psalm 40 here in reference to Jesus, who is also the rock of verse 2. He set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. You've got small r rock and capital R rock. Just like you had small r recovery and capital R recovery. And the small r rock is a firm place to stand after the bog. It's the place on which David composes this psalm. But likewise, there's a capital R rock, the person of Jesus, the rock of our salvation, in whom our hopes are set. Small r recovery, capital R recovery, small r rock, capital R rock. I'm just saying to you that the Lord is the ultimate difference maker in experience. One doesn't wait patiently, bearing the burden of hoping for the Lord to do nothing. We wait for him to set our feet upon a rock, verse 2. Make our steps secure, also verse 2. Verse 3, put a new song in our mouth, a song of praise to our God. After lament, many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. In other words, many will see and fear. To fear is to take the Lord seriously. A delivering God, a God who can deliver you from the pit and the bog, is a God people will more often than not take seriously. A God who rescues us from ourselves and from those bent on our destruction is trustworthy, but he may delay that deliverance and that rescue. And so in practicing patience for ourselves and others that we may cry out to God for, what we're doing in that patience is we're aligning ourselves with everything God has promised to be for us in Jesus, meaning he has promised to be our hope. That's the word that contains all those promises. And hope, biblically considered in Christian experience, is a convictional assurance of God's goodness and his trustworthiness. Not just goodness and trustworthiness in the abstract, but personally experienced. I will know in real time the goodness of the Lord. I will know in real time that he is trustworthy. Time is the frustrating part, though. And this tension is set in this psalm. We want God to make haste. Look at it, verse 13. Be pleased, O Lord, to deliver me. O Lord, verse 13, make haste to help me. Coming on the heels of verse 12, when evils have encompassed me beyond number, my iniquities have overtaken me, I cannot see, they are more than the hairs of my head, my heart fails me. And then verse 17, again, the last verse in the psalm, you are my help and my deliverer, last part of verse 17, do not delay, do not delay. We want out of this painful thing. Verse 2, he drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog. That's what we want. Whether we put ourselves there or someone else, someone else's wrong against us, we want out. We never wanted to be in the first place. And especially had we foreseen the trouble that we would cause ourselves or those close to us when we took that washed out road. But the way David composes Psalm 40, we're just sort of walking through this. This is a bit of a meandering approach to the text. But if you'll notice some things, look at verses 5, 11, and 17. And in verse 5, he says, you've multiplied, O Lord my God, your wondrous deeds and your thoughts toward us. In verse 11, he says, you will not restrain your mercy from me. In verse 17, he says, the Lord takes thought for me. And even so, we may yet know more trouble. See, we have this sense, a lot of us, of one and done. I'm not sure where we get this sense from, but we have it. That if we go through certain kinds of trouble or pain, that we've been there and done that, we won't return. Lightning doesn't strike twice and all that. Actually, lightning does strike twice. It actually can. And likewise, it's not a given that we won't repeat an experience again. We may yet. Something else wicked may this way come that is just as hurtful. I know of a family, not in our church, who went through with a son what we're in with ours currently, and they had a daughter who gave them no trouble. In fact, she rescued their son when he was at his worst. That's part of the story. His sister broke in on the place where he was dying and said, "I've had enough of watching you do this to our family," and took him to get help, and he credited her with saving his life. His sister did that, their daughter. She was a very accomplished person. Their girl had done everything right, but then she up and left her husband and her children. Decided she wanted a different life, and there were her parents plunged again into the pit and bog of emotionally draining pain, and this time from a child who for over 3 decades had given them nothing to worry about. Psalm 40 addresses painful realities that we don't see coming. You don't see the pit or the bog necessarily. And I think this is a good place in this psalm to consider the different things we do with our pain. I'll give you 4 of these if you want to number them. And I appreciate the help in this from a book by Frederick Buechner called A Crazy Holy Grace. Crazy and holy because Buechner revisits pains in his life like his father's suicide when he was just a boy. He can remember looking out the upper floor window of his house at his father's form in the driveway and his mother and his grandmother lamenting this that had happened to him. Buechner remembers back to his daughter's eating disorder that almost took her life. He's in his 90s now, his early 90s, and he speaks of the different things that we do with our pains. One thing we do is we shut it up away from ourselves, the painful thing. We attempt to forget whatever happened did. It's like it's not there. It's the elephant in the room, but we're not going to talk about it. And Buechner says the price that we pay in dealing with our pain that way, by stuffing it, by trying to forget it, is that a part of you doesn't grow. You get stunted. The compassionate part of you doesn't grow. If you shut yourself off from your own pain, you won't be open to others in their pain. Your reach to them is shortened. The way we grow in compassion and mercy for others is by realizing our own pain. Another thing we do with our painful things, the second thing if you're listing these, is we shut down. This is different from shutting it away. In shutting down, we never get out of the shadow of the painful thing that happened. In shutting away, we stuff it in a closet, as it were, and we lock that closet and throw away the key. But in shutting down, we move into the pain to reside there. It's like a kind of confinement. It dominates and defines us. As an example of this from literature, some of you literature buffs will recall Miss Havisham in Great Expectations, Charles Dickens' novel. Miss Havisham was jilted on her wedding day. She was left at the altar. Horrible thing to have happen. And her life at that point effectively ended. The rest of her life she spent in her wedding dress, which was tattered and moldered through the years. The cake, the wedding cake, was still on the table with cobwebs and mice nibbling all around it, sitting there for decades. Miss Havisham was hurt so deeply, but she prolonged and resided in that pain. She shut down. Another thing we do with our pain, a third thing, is we turn it into a kind of accomplishment. We can either shut it away from ourselves, or we can shut down in it, or we can turn it into a kind of accomplishment. It's the sense that we become almost exhibitionist. We become proud of ourselves for the trouble we've seen. You think you've suffered? Well, let me tell you what's happened to me. You've got scars? Check out mine. Longer and deeper than yours, I bet. Or we don't say or think that exactly, but we find ourselves immediately and passionately resentful of the person that we perceive to be crying over a paper cut when we were gashed. We've licked that wound so much, we've come to regard the taste. One more thing we do, a fourth thing, is we make a joke of our pain. gallows humor. We take a kind of grim pleasure in it. If you listen to comedians, I have a satellite radio subscription in my truck, and one of my presets is a channel with comics. Comedians are interesting because a lot of them come from really broken places. And oftentimes in their humor, you can detect there's a lot of pain and even anger under there that they're joking about. We laugh about how dysfunctional things are for us when we take our pain this direction, almost like we would now prefer that it was this way all along, you know. And sometimes we have to laugh because we've cried for so long. And sometimes things that weren't funny in the moment are later when we think on them again because they were just so ridiculous, and you look back a year later and you go, remember when that happened? That was just so stupid. And you find yourself laughing because it was just that stupid. But turning something painful into something that we try to laugh off is a form of hiding. It's a form of hiding. Now, against these four things, let's set a fifth. And this comes from Psalm 40. In Psalm 40, David recounts, he doesn't give us details, it's veiled, but it was difficult, whatever the stretch he was in and went through, and he cried out to God for relief, for preservation, for deliverance, and he got it. Again, verse 3, many took God more seriously as a result of David's deliverance. Verse 16, may those who love your salvation say continually, great is the Lord for the great things he's done. And let me tell you about one of the great things he's done, David says. Here's what he did in my life. Put my feet on a rock. But whereas the four things I listed are what not to do with pain, this fifth thing is something we should do, and it comes from verses 9 and 10. I mentioned in the beginning we would sort of key on 9 and 10. Verse 9, I have told the glad news of deliverance in the great congregation. Behold, I have not restrained my lips, as you know, O Lord. I have not hidden your deliverance within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your steadfast love, which we recited in unison this morning. His steadfast love endures forever. Here it is again. I have not concealed your steadfast love and your faithfulness from the great congregation. Now, it's easy for us to misunderstand this at first reading because what we immediately think of is what I'm doing, upfront speaking. So a bunch of people got together and I stood up and I said, here's what happened and here's what the Lord did for me. Or it's kind of a group sharing. We think of this as out loud, I'm owning it, etc. But this telling the great congregation, which is repeated twice in verses 9 and 10, telling the great congregation is less about that, about the means. It's more about the stewardship of pain. He's saying in verses 9 and 10, I've been a good steward of this pain. I will be a good steward of this pain, not just in pointing God to your deliverance of me from it, but also pointing to your faithfulness to me in it. Could we get both in verse 10? I've not hidden your deliverance within my heart. I've spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation, both and. Not just deliverance from, but faithfulness in the pit, in the bog. God wasn't absent there, though he may not be perceived there. Have you ever heard of something called quantum weirdness? Did you know that's an actual term that contemporary physicists use for this phenomenon? Now, I'm not a physicist, but I can try to explain this to you the best I'm able. An observed particle, like an electron, that can be humanly observed. An observed particle, physicists have learned that an observed particle that they're watching behaves very differently from an unobserved particle. In this way, a humanly observed particle passed through a screen will always go through one hole. However, an unobserved particle that is yet mechanically monitored, it passes through multiple holes in a screen. What quantum physicists take from that is what we call reality is conditioned by the limitation of our senses. that there is a reality beyond our senses, much larger and more complex than we're able to perceive. There's a fixed reality apart from our direct observations. Now, that's not news to those of us who hold to a universe made and set and ordered by an infinite God. But God's faithfulness in real time is like this too. I can't always perceive his working due to the limitations, my grief, my anger, my weariness, my helplessness in this imposes on me, which tends to get my total focus. Or I'm observing my situation and I'm expecting God to do this or take this or give this, and it becomes that. There's a plot twist. The situation takes on shapes and forms that I couldn't see coming. Why? Because there is more to the reality of God's working than we know. Even in physics, God has deposited this hint of himself, how he works in observed and unobserved particles. The term quantum weirdness, by the way, bears the materialistic assumption that we should be able to account for all reality ourselves. So it's weird to us that we can't account for this greater reality. The physicists call that quantum weirdness. The Christians call that crazy holy grace. Frederick Buechner's words on this: we are all so good at sharing from the shallows of our life, but to speak out of the depths are scary. To go down to the depths of your past, to go down to the depths of your secrets, to go down to the depths of your pain is scary business, because we don't often know what we're going to find there. And we don't know how to bring it up. But this is what we do in stewardship of painful things. We speak out of the depths we've gone down to and may still be in, or may be coming out of, or may be going back into. This is full of risks, as I said last week. And practically consider, just as a practical notation on this, you can't do this with everyone. You can't operate in and from the depths with everyone equally. Our family saga is now something of public domain by way of what I'm doing and my role. And we've had a great outpouring of support from many of you. Thank you. We are grateful for every card and letter. We've not shared this to get that, but in sharing this, we have dwelled in your good words to us. Those cards, those letters, those emails, those texts, those mean a lot to us. They really do. The kindness you're showing us is incredible. Thank you many times over to each and all of you, those of you we know and those we're just meeting in this who have conveyed your support and your confidence in the deliverance of God. But you know, it can be exhausting emotionally to be continually asked about it. That's the other side of the coin. Because then we have to go there. So while the stewardship of pain means we share from our depths rather than denying it or hiding from it or shielding or shutting it all down, we can't cover the ground with everyone, even in the midst of incredible outpouring. And so we've built community around us for this. We've got burden bearers that we don't have to explain anything to. And they know us in this, and they know when to ask us and how to help us and when to offer. And many of them, it's because they've been there themselves. I address this not just for us, but really for others I've known through the years who are tasked with the stewardship of pain, going through something hard. For them, it may be a chronic illness, it may be the loss of a family member, and they've told me how they will avoid, at times, going to church gatherings because they just don't want to talk about it again. Whatever it is, and they know someone will ask, and they know the asking is very well-intentioned, it is, but they just don't want to go there again. And that doesn't mean they're hiding, it just means they're exhausted. It's exhausting to have to constantly revisit the subject. No one wants their pain to be a conversation piece. No one wants to be hailed across the parking lot, hey, how's your son doing? You know, as you're getting into your truck. It's not for that. It reminds me of a scene in a Western movie where a guy is recovering from a gunshot wound to his leg, and another guy who was there with him when he was shot a day later kind of breezily says to him, "How's that leg?" And the guy says, "Full of torment. Thanks for asking." So there's a fine line. By the way, that movie was The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. All right, that was that movie. There's a fine line between showing you care, and that's what 99% of you do. You show that you genuinely care, you genuinely pray. There's a fine line between that and caring that you show yourself to be caring. And it's a fine line. We don't always know where that line is, and so there's grace for one another in this. I'm just saying bearing the burden of hoping is emotionally wearisome, even when you have great support, like Lynn and I do. And we do have great support. We're not alone in this. Even so, you still pray. Verse 13, "Lord, make haste to help me." Verse 17, "Don't delay, God, because I'm tired of this. I'm tired of the thing itself. I'm tired of the attention that it requires." And that's just a human response. Thankful to be part of a church that gives us the grace to be human. Thank you. In verse 11, we get the divine response. Verse 11, "As for you, O Lord, you will not restrain your mercy from me. Your steadfast love and your faithfulness will ever preserve me." You know what that says? God is not exhausted by us and our problems. And he acts in accounted for and unaccounted for ways. He acts in keeping with his purposes and whatever accrues the greatest glory to himself. You know, some have said when Caleb comes out of this, man, Caleb, the reach with people that he will have that, Cole, you never will have. And that's true, and that may be if he comes out of this, but that's not where our hope is. As I said earlier, what David signals with verses 9 and 10 about the stewardship of pain, not just pointing to God's deliverance from it, but his faithfulness in it as well. That's the better part of hoping. David isn't banking his hope on the ministry value of said trouble. Hope isn't for that. It isn't for wishing our troubles away. It isn't for ministry value, whatever ministry value comes out of it. Hope is for drawing into God for himself. For himself. You've quoted it 1,000 times in your life if you've been in the Psalms and walked with the Lord for a long. Psalm 73, "Whom have I in heaven but you, and earth has nothing I desire beside you." That's got to be one of the most hard things to say. And I don't know that I've ever said that genuinely. I don't know that I ever will say that genuinely this side of heaven. It's something to aspire to, but you go through something like this and you recognize somewhere in it, you know, is my hope in getting certain things from God, or is my hope in God for himself? Do I love God for the things God's done for me and given me? Yes, in a sense, yes. He's given me salvation. That's his initiative, and I love him for that. But do I if I never knew an iota of the goodness of God beyond my salvation, would I still love him? Hope is for standing in that chesed love. I had a cold this week, so I can't pronounce the Hebrew the way it's supposed to be pronounced. You don't want to hear me do that, is what I'm trying to say. You can tell I'm a little congested, I think. Hope is for standing on the steadfast goodness of God, his loyal love and his goodness personally exemplified in Jesus and experienced in his grace. One of my favorite lines in all the Bible is verse 17, "The Lord takes thought for me." I love that. And how do I know he does? How do I know he is, verse 17, "my help and my deliverer"? Do not delay. How do I know that? Verse 7, "Then I said, behold, I have come." The reason I know is because God became flesh to come to the pit, to come to the bog, to draw us up from it before he went down into it himself. Not before he went down into it himself. For coming in flesh meant he would know what it is to be oppressed and opposed and hurt and have his life snatched away from him. And yet he did his Father's will so completely In a psalm that celebrates recovery, you've got the Messiah in the middle of it because he did his Father's will so completely, so thoroughly, that nothing he's done for us can be undone by anyone. And nothing he does for anyone will fail. And so on that thought, let's conclude. Stand with me, let's pray, and then we've got a song.